Evangelical Christianity and conservative politics are so intertwined today that it is difficult to imagine a time when this was not the case. But when Jimmy Carter won the presidency in 1976, it was in part thanks to support from evangelical voters who had long avoided politics. Once they became politically engaged, they were just as quickly co-opted by the extreme religious right and other conservative leaders and abandoned Carter during his re-election bid. The rest, as they say, is history. Randall Balmer is chair of the religion department and Mendel Family Professor of Arts and Sciences at Dartmouth and author of more than a dozen books, including his latest Redeemer, The Life of Jimmy Carter, in which he reveals how the 39th president's rise and fall mirrored the transformation of American religious and political culture. It's a great pleasure to welcome Randall Balmer to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's very nice to have you with us. At what point did you start to make that connection in politics and specifically on the shoulders of Jimmy Carter?
Well, I've long been interested in the topic. I've been kind of a political junkie for much of my life, I suppose. But I remember that when Jimmy Carter burst on the scene in the early 1970s, I was at that time a student at an evangelical college in northern Illinois, and I wanted to I was intrigued by this, particularly his talk about being a born-again Christian, which is how we described ourselves. That combination with his political ambitions captured my attention way back in the early and mid-1970s.
At what point do you think it started to emerge in his campaign? It seems in the book like it was part of him from the very beginning, that it was not something he was going to shy in talking about in any way.
That's right. What was a bit of a surprise to me as I began writing his biography is that his real religious or spiritual influence was his father rather than his mother. Many people remember Miss Lillian, Jimmy Carter's mother, as being this person who went to the Peace Corps with India, went to India with the Peace Corps, rather, when she was 68 years old. And I thought it was really his mother who was the formative influence on his life. Turned out it was his father, Earl Carter, who was a deacon at Plains Baptist Church and also a Sunday school teacher and a youth leader. And Jimmy Carter really admired his father. And when his father began to fail physically at the age of only 53 because of his smoking habit, actually, Jimmy Carter was given a release or leave from his Navy responsibilities, went to Plains, and there he saw people coming by that hospital room talking about the various acts of kindness and generosity that Mr. Earl, as he was known, had given or had performed there in the community, giving a family a new set of clothes, for example, so they could attend their daughter's graduation, or making mortgage payments for another family in a time of financial crisis, or extended credit from the Carter store and warehouse. And that made a deep, deep impression on Jimmy Carter. So I think you're right. His religious roots are long and deep and long preceded his campaign for the presidency in 1976.
So what was it about the campaign that lured in evangelicals who really for the half a century before that were on the sidelines?
Well, I think it was just the novelty of being able to vote for somebody who claimed to be an evangelical Christian. And this was something that really hadn't happened in American politics since William Jennings Bryan in the early part of the 20th century, when he ran actually three times. He was the Democratic nominee for president. And so when Jimmy Carter burst on the scene talking about his born-again faith, talking about being a Southern Baptist Sunday school teacher, I think a lot of evangelicals were just kind of swept along with that. The other thing that was happening in the early 1970s was that there was a kind of brief resurgence of what I call progressive evangelicalism. In the fall of 1973, there was a remarkable gathering of evangelical leaders in Chicago at the YMCA, and they came out of that meeting with something called the Chicago Declaration of Evangelical Social Concern, which decried America's persistent racism, militarism, also the yawning gap between rich and poor, and the fact that many Americans, and as well as people around the world, went to bed hungry every night. It also reaffirmed the notion of women's equality, and all of those had been part of evangelicalism in the 19th century, this movement called progressive evangelicalism that was really very influential in American life and even American politics in the 19th century. So Jimmy Carter comes along and he repeats many of these same principles in his bid for the White House in the mid-1970s.
You address this in the book, but he grew up in a racially mixed environment. What impact did that have on his campaign and his message, and ultimately dealing with African Americans and African American voters?
He was very much at ease with African Americans, in part, as you said, because of his childhood. His closest friends and playmates when he was growing up in Archery, Georgia, which is just 3 miles down the road from Plains, were African Americans. And as the campaign was beginning to take shape in the mid-1970s, Andrew Young, who of course was a member of Congress from Georgia and later became Carter's representative to the United Nations, Andrew Young noted that what set Jimmy Carter apart from all the other Democratic nominees for president is that he felt entirely at ease in the presence of African Americans, whereas the other candidates have kind of felt uneasy and kind of clutched when they were in a room with members of the Black Congressional Caucus, for example. And that impressed Andy Young significantly. And that's one of the reasons that he threw his support behind Jimmy Carter very, very early on in Carter's campaign for the White House.
You include a quote in the book from his 1970 gubernatorial campaign in which he told Vernon Jordan, quote, "You won't like my campaign, but you will like my administration."
The 1970 campaign is, I think, a real black mark in the life and story of Jimmy Carter, and it's something that he regrets deeply. What happened was that in 1966, he ran for governor and lost to, of all people, Lester Maddox, a notorious segregationist. And Jimmy Carter himself was utterly, utterly undone by that campaign. Financially, he had sunk a lot of money into that race for governor, and so his resources were depleted. Emotionally, he was distraught. Physically, he had lost 22 pounds in the course of that campaign because he campaigned so vigorously for that office. And he goes back to Plains, and family members talk about seeing him kind of wandering aimlessly in the fields outside of Plains, very often in tears because of this. And this is the context for his religious renewal. He had a long conversation with his sister, Ruth Carter Stapleton, who was a Pentecostal evangelist, and really rededicates his life to Jesus and has a transformative religious experience on the heels of that campaign in 1966. Almost immediately after losing in 1966, he decides to run again in 1970, but he's determined not to lose a second time. And the dark side of that campaign is that the Carter campaign, if not so much Jimmy Carter himself, nevertheless, he's responsible, that Carter campaign courts the segregationist vote, and that was the context for his remark to Vernon Jordan, "You won't like my campaign, but you will like my administration."
Randall Balmer is the chair of the religion department and professor of arts and sciences at Dartmouth and author of the new book, Redeemer, The Life of Jimmy Carter. So let's get into the large issue, and I'll ask a big question, and then we can start to parse it out a little bit, and that is about abortion. What is fascinating in the book is that you write how evangelical Christians came to the side of Jimmy Carter in the 1976 election, But then started to desert him because of his, ultimately, because of his views on abortion. He was pro-choice, even though personally against abortion. But what I was fascinated by was how much it was an issue in the 1976 campaign itself. Why did it not hurt him then and then hurt him later?
It's a great question. In many ways, that was the question that motivated this entire project, trying to figure out how it was that evangelical voters who had helped to propel Jimmy Carter to the White House in 1976 turned so dramatically against him 4 years later. The immediate answer to your question is that in 1976, abortion was considered by evangelicals to be a Catholic issue. It simply was not a matter that they had taken up for themselves when they considered how they might vote. And the longer history of this is that going back to the late 1960s, 1968, there was a gathering, or a conference rather, organized by Christianity Today magazine, which is kind of the flagship magazine for evangelicalism, together with a group called the Christian Medical Society to discuss the morality surrounding abortion. And what comes out of that gathering, of that conference, is that there's a statement saying we can't agree on the morality of abortion, but we are agreed that abortion should be allowed in certain circumstances, and not merely for the standard or the now standard exemptions of rape and incest and sexual assault and so forth. In 1971, before the Roe v. Wade ruling, the Southern Baptist Convention meeting in St. Louis, Missouri, passed a resolution calling for the legalization of abortion, a resolution they reaffirmed in 1974 after the Roe ruling, and again in 1976. When the Roe v. Wade decision was handed down in January of 1973, several prominent evangelicals, including W.A. Criswell of First Baptist Church in Dallas, expressed support for the Roe v. Wade ruling as marking an appropriate distinction between personal morality and public policy. So, again, getting back to answer your question more specifically, in 1976, abortion simply was not on the radar screen of most evangelicals and certainly not a motivation for them to vote one way or another politically. Catholics were against abortion, certainly the Catholic leadership, the bishops were against abortion. And in 1976, Carter had to address that issue in order to retain the Catholic vote. But for evangelicals, abortion simply was not an issue in 1976.
And you detail in the book of how there was a masterminding almost of expanding abortion from a Catholic issue to an evangelical one.
Yes, this to me was really fascinating. I did a lot of archival research, as you know, from having read the book. I went to the Liberty University archives, which is Jerry Falwell's university, of course, and to Bob Jones University. The Carter Library, of course, in Atlanta, but also the Gerald Ford Library in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and the Reagan Library out in California. But in many ways, the most important archival work I did was out at the University of Wyoming in Laramie, which is where Paul Weyrich's papers are held. And Weyrich is really the architect of the religious right. What became clear, looking through all these archival sources, is that what motivated evangelicals to organize politically was not, as I said earlier, the abortion issue. That didn't come into the picture until 1979, actually, right before the 1980 election. What motivated them to get involved politically was when the Internal Revenue Service began rescinding the tax exemption of schools like Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina, because of their racially discriminatory policies. As the IRS throughout the 1970s began to rescind the tax exemption of places like Bob Jones University, which they did in 1976 at Bob Jones, that is what got people like Jerry Falwell agitated and determined to organize into a political force. Falwell famously said that in some states, it's easier to open a massage parlor than it is a so-called Christian school, meaning that IRS regulations on the issue of race made it difficult to win a tax exemption for these schools. So that's what really gets them motivated, and it's only later, after the 1978 by-elections, that evangelicals become sensitized to the issue of abortion.
Interestingly enough, during the 1980 campaign against Ronald Reagan, Carter, it is brought up several times that Carter has not done much for evangelicals. There is the issue of abortion, and as you point out in the book, that leaders of the religious right who ultimately helped Reagan defeat Carter quickly found out that Reagan would fail them and ultimately fail to deliver on the promises that he made during the campaign.
That's right. And what's interesting about the courtship between the religious right and Reagan is that it was a kind of uneasy relationship from the beginning. There was no foregone conclusion going into the 1980 campaign that Reagan would be the choice of the religious right. In fact, they looked at several other candidates, Phil Crane, who was a congressman from Illinois, but also John Connally, who had been governor of Texas, and then Richard Nixon's secretary of the Treasury before he switched his party affiliation to Republican in the early part of the 1970s. And there's this wonderful moment, I love this, when a delegation of religious right preachers was dispatched to visit John Connally at his ranch to find out if he would be their candidate in 1980. And one of the questions was what Connally thought about secular humanism. And no one apparently had briefed Connally that secular humanism was a kind of code word or a code term for everything that was wrong in America. And Connally replied in his Texas accent, well, I don't know much about it, but it sounds good to me. And that, of course, utterly closed the door on any thought that John Connally would be the candidate of the religious right in 1980. But Reagan was not a slam dunk either in terms of his faith. As governor of California in 1967, he had signed into law the most liberal abortion bill in the country. By 1980, he had come around to a pro-life position, of course, which was important to people like Falwell and Weyrich and others. But early in that campaign, he was asked if he was a born-again Christian, and he had to be briefed about what exactly that was. And once he was briefed, he said, well, I suppose I would qualify for that. And the other thing going against Reagan was the fact that he was divorced, which at that time was a huge, huge issue for evangelicals. I remember my mother telling me in the mid-1960s that we as a family could never support Nelson Rockefeller for president because he was divorced. Mm. And the final issue was that Reagan was not anything but an episodic attender at church. He was not certainly nothing, nothing compared to Jimmy Carter and Jimmy Carter's involvement in church. So the Reagan courtship was somewhat uneasy, even in the early months of 1980.
Another fascinating aspect of the book, as we wrap up, is that given Carter's views and thoughts on such issues as health care and energy and economic equality and, of course, women's rights, which is the subject of his latest book, he was really one of our most progressive presidents that we've ever seen, and certainly far ahead of his time on many issues.
Yes, absolutely. I would say far ahead of his time, but in many ways also tapping into 19th century evangelical activism, which very much was concerned with those on the margins of society. But yes, certainly in comparison with the Reagan years and with the political landscape since 1980, Jimmy Carter is very much a progressive, even a liberal evangelical, although liberals considered by many to be a bad word these days. I think he fits into that category. Now, one of the great ironies and yet another paradox for the Carter presidency is that in 1980, many people in his own party, the Democratic Party, didn't consider him liberal enough. And he, of course, faced a very damaging primary season with the challenge from Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts, and that hurt him unmistakably going into the general election in 1980.
You note in the at the end of the book that his activities, obviously, since leaving office, earned him great praise and even a Nobel Peace Prize in 2002. And you write a line that I love. At what point does Carter earn a reprieve from his moral exertions? When can he relax and settle into a hard-won retirement? He's 90 years old.
He'll be 90 years old on October 1st, yes, and he shows no signs of slowing down. And some people have interpreted my comments there to be critical of him, and I didn't really mean that at all. I meant it really as admiration. Here he is, somebody who could, like other former presidents, kind of relax into a genteel retirement, and Carter hasn't done that. I think part of it, and he acknowledged this to me in one of our conversations, he said, if I hadn't lost the election in 1980, I probably would never have started the Carter Center and done all the humanitarian work that he's done since leaving office. So I take that as I admire him. I didn't mean this critically of him. But there is a kind of drivenness to Jimmy Carter, even now when he's approaching 90 years old. He sees things in the world that can be changed and should be changed, and he's willing to invest his energies to make those changes. And I think that's really quite admirable. At the same time, I think he probably has earned the right to slow down a little bit. In my conversation with Rosalind, she said, I don't look at the calendar more than a week and a half in advance because I have no idea where we're going. I just can't keep up. But there's a kind of what I call in the book frenetic benevolence to Jimmy Carter that, again, I think is really quite admirable.
And we just had him on the show. I mean, he has a list a mile long of things that he wants to accomplish.
He's still very vigorous, no question about that. And there's another lesson, I suppose, too, not that we need to emphasize this any more than has already been established, but all of his siblings and both of his parents died of pancreatic cancer at a reasonably young age for all of them. All of them were smokers. Jimmy Carter never was a smoker. And so if you want yet another at least anecdotal example of the importance of staying away from that, Jimmy Carter provides that with his vigor at the age of 90.
The name of the book is Redeemer, The Life of Jimmy Carter. It is published by Basic Books. Randall Baumer is a professor in the arts and sciences at Dartmouth College, an Episcopal priest, and author, again, of the new book, Redeemer. Randall, thank you very much for being with us. A great conversation. I appreciate you sharing with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is Redeemer, The Life of Jimmy Carter, published by Basic Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.